The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
One of the greatest discoveries uncovered here in the Chinyon Givati is a complicated fortification system that was discovered here in recent months. It includes a wide city wall, a large monumental tower, and a glacis. Together with so many coins, all are dated to the Seleucid presence here in Jerusalem, we can actually view again the the real history of Jerusalem here in front of our eyes, that includes the tower recently discovered, part of the city wall, okay? A large glacis going all the way, sloping down to the Tropeon Valley, and this mirrors in the other side with other remains that were uncovered years ago in Area G, in the other side of the hill, and all together help us reconstruct again this fortress, stronghold, that used to house the upper part of the city of David here. This is part of the Hellenistic aqua. So well documented in different historical sources, among the relevant ones are Josephus and Maccabean Book 1. And they all tell us about the history here in this city, but so far archaeologists failed to uncover remains that could be securely dated and related to this fortress. This is one of the puzzling questions that archaeologists in the, I dare to say, 100 years of archaeological excavation here in Jerusalem, in general, in the city of David in particular, failed to uncover real remains that could be related to this scenario. And today I think we are giving a good answer to the question, where was the Hellenistic and aqua here in Jerusalem? It is here in the upper part of the city of David, exactly as these historical sources mention again and again, but we, for different reason, failed to see. And this is the real excitement in the discovery here in the Givati excavations.
Welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I'm Brant Nuchtigal, and I'll be filling in for Stephen Flurry today. Now, that clip you're just listening to comes from an archaeologist here in Jerusalem named Doron Ben-Ami. He excavates in the city of David, and that was an announcement that he gave back to the press at the end of last year. He was announcing the discovery of the famous Greek citadel known to historical sources as the Acra. Now, one thing that Doron failed to mention in that clip just then is who constructed that fortress. Now, for that, we have to consult some historical sources, and the one I'd like to go to straight away here is the first book of the Maccabees. This is what the first book of the Maccabees writes about that fortress. It says, "He plundered the city of Jerusalem and set fire to it, demolished its houses and its surrounding walls. He took captive women and children and seized the cattle. Then they built up the city of David with its high massive wall and strong towers, and it became their citadel, their Acra." Now, up until that announcement, there had been little found in Jerusalem, especially in this area of the city of David, that testified to this Acra's existence. Historical sources had said, even as he said in that clip, that it should be in the northern reaches of the city of David, and yet up to this point, late last year, that Acra had not been found. Now, along with the city wall that was discovered there, there was a massive slope coming against that wall, as he was talking about, known as a glacis. And the glacis in this embankment was made up of soil, of stones, of plaster that was designed to keep attackers away from the base of the wall. It's just a very normal defensive feature of a city wall like that. Now, according to the press release from Durun Ben Ami's dig, inside that glacier, they found lots of material that give a very specific date. Yes, it was from the Seleucid period, ranging from around 200 BC. But we can get even more specific about the dating, and therefore the person that constructed that, from other things found in that glacier. Notably, they had arrowheads featuring the trident symbol on them, and then they also had coins. And some of the coins featured the face of one known to history as Antiochus Epiphanes. Yes, Antiochus Epiphanes. He was the one that constructed this Acra fortress that is rising out of the ground once again in Jerusalem. But who was Antiochus Epiphanes? Now, if you've been listening to this radio program for very long, you've no doubt heard the name of Antiochus. More importantly, because there are Bible prophecies that say specifically that in this end time, there will be types of Antiochus Epiphanes on the scene. And in many ways, those types will mimic and imitate the destructive work of the earlier Antiochus. So my purpose in this program today is not to discuss the Antiochus on the scene today. If you want to learn about that prophetic fulfillment, you can request the booklet, America Under Attack. It goes into detail about the modern types of Antiochus. My purpose today is to look back to that original Antiochus Epiphanes from 2,000 years ago, to scour the historical sources and capture a picture of the personality, the character traits, and even the political objectives of the original Antiochus. And in doing so, we can more readily understand and recognize those latter-day types we see on the scene today. It would be important for you to, if you have them handy, to grab your Bible and turn to Daniel chapter 11. And while you do that, we'll take a short break. And then when we return, we'll be discussing the historical Antiochus Epiphanes.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily. The relatively new science of archaeology, the digging up and study of the material remains of man's past, has confirmed without question the historical accuracy of the Bible. Solid, documented evidence, apart from the Bible, confirms events and persons that at one time were known to us only from Scripture. The Bible is real. And you need to pay attention to it. Call now and request your free copy of The Authority of the Bible. This lesson, which comes from the Armstrong College Bible Correspondence Course, blows the dust off your Bible. You will learn how to mine the treasures buried in the greatest book on earth. You can discover its secrets and enrich your life today. For more information, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Before the break, I asked you to grab your Bibles and turn to Daniel 11 if you could, because this chapter is one of the most dramatic and specific prophecies in the entire Bible. Indeed, if you've read Herbert W. Armstrong's book, Proof of the Bible, he uses this chapter, Daniel chapter 11, as one of the strongest proofs of God's existence and the infallibility of Scripture. Now, Daniel chapter 11, it was given to the prophet Daniel very late in his life. It even records in the previous chapter how two archangels had to come on the scene to help Daniel to receive this revelation. And what Daniel 11 then details is a history of basically the time period from the Persian Empire all the way through till the end of the Seleucid Empire, with the Romans coming on the scene. And then towards the end of that, it has more about the latter day type, the end time types of this fulfilled prophecy of Daniel chapter 11. But we're going to concern ourselves mainly with the historical parts of this prophecy that have already been fulfilled. Most of this book, in a way, has already been fulfilled anciently between the dealings between two empires, one of which known into history as the Seleucid Empire and the other one known to history as the Ptolemaic Empire. Now, just to recap on that history a little bit to get our bearings, most people have heard of Alexander the Great. Now, he ruled around 330 BC, and he only ruled for a short while. He only ruled for 10 or so years. He went through the whole Middle East, part of most of the known world, conquering that. And that then when he was strong and when he was had fully conquered that territory, he died. And over the next 20 years, his kingdom fell into turmoil. There wasn't a clear successor who would rule after him. So you had, after those 20 years following his death, about four former generals rising up, splitting up the territory of Alexander the Great. Now, two of those leaders, those territorial leaders, were known as Seleucus, and he ruled over the territory of Syria, going on into modern Turkey, across into Iran. He had the largest territory. And one of the other generals that ruled was known as Ptolemy, and he ruled over the territory down in Egypt. So you have these two kingdoms, and this is what Daniel chapter 11 mainly is concerned about. Now, we're not going to go through all of Daniel chapter 11 because we're mostly concerned about Antiochus Epiphanes, and he came on the scene about 120 years following the dissolution of Alexander the Great's empire. If you want to learn more about this startling prophecy, please go to thetrumpet.com and look for the History and the Prophecy of the Middle East booklet, History and Prophecy of the Middle East, and you're going to find a very detailed explanation of Daniel chapter 11 with historical sources showing how it was fulfilled to a T. And it is breathtaking if you do that. You'll come out of that study amazed at the startling accuracy of biblical prophecy that has already become history for us. Now, when we look at this history in Daniel chapter 11 regarding Antiochus Epiphanes, it's important to remember that this, while we can read it as history, it is actually prophecy. It was prophesied a couple hundred years before it actually happened, but it is so startlingly accurate that we can read it as history. And in fact, it's so accurate that people and a lot of scholars will discredit the latter half of the book of Daniel and say that it was written after because it's so accurate, because it was fulfilled to a T. Now, I'm not going into a lecture on proving why Daniel was written by the prophet Daniel. You can do that by yourself if you like. There's plenty of evidence to show that Daniel wrote the entire book. But if you have Daniel chapter 11 open, let's just read verse 18. Now, this isn't talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. This is talking about his father, Antiochus III, or Antiochus the Great. It says here, "After this shall he turn his face unto the isles," this is referring to the Greek isles, "and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him." So this is describing the venture that Antiochus the Great was going to have into Greece. Now, when he got there, he had some successes early on, but then the Romans came across and pushed Antiochus the Great out. Now, there was also some terms that were demanded of Antiochus the Great that have a lot to do with Antiochus Epiphanes. Some retribution, some things that he would have to pay because he lost to the Romans, was forced out of Greece by the Romans. One of those is that one of his sons would have to be a political prisoner in Rome. And the son that was going to have to travel to Rome to do this was not his eldest son, Seleucus Philopater, whom we'll talk about in a bit, but his second eldest son, Antiochus IV, who had to go to Rome. The other thing, one of the other things that Antiochus the Great had to do was pay a yearly tribute to Rome that was quite substantial. And that's when we move on here in the book of Daniel, and we see why there has to be this raiser of taxes mentioned in verse 20. Verse 19 talks about how when he's going to return to his land, he's going to fall, and that means he's going to be killed. But look who will stand up in his estate. Verse 20, then shall stand up in his estate, or the office of king of the Seleucid Empire, a raiser of taxes in the glory of his kingdom. But within a few days, after a short while, he shall be destroyed neither in anger nor in battle. This is referring to Seleucus Philopater, his eldest son, who naturally would have the throne after his father died. Now, to pay off the war debt owed to the Romans, he had to raise taxes throughout the land to ensure that he could pay that. But it says there that in time he would be killed. Now, he was eventually poisoned by the man that he told to go and collect the taxes from the Syrian region. And after he was killed, this guy that collected the taxes named Heliodorus, he took the Seleucid kingdom for himself, but not for long. Let's read verse 21. It says, and in his estate, that is again the estate of the king of the Seleucid Empire, shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Now, this man is known to history, again, as Antiochus the Epiphanes or Antiochus the Fourth. He was going to usurp the throne for himself. Seleucus Philopater had a son. Though young, he had a son, and he should have been the rightful heir to the Seleucid throne. Instead, we have Antiochus Epiphanes coming and taking his brother, taking the throne away from his nephew. Now, just backtracking a little bit, I just like to talk about what his education would have given him inside Rome, the Roman Empire at the time. Again, he was sent there because of the loss of his father against the Romans when he was fighting in Greece. Now, the Romans, they understood that the Seleucid power was quite strong, and they endeavored to raise Antiochus as a teen that he probably was in a way that would ensure he would think of the Romans in a favorable light and potentially ensure some type of harmonious existence between the two empires. That is, probably until the Romans wanted to take over. So instead of being incarcerated as a hostage, like we think of a hostage, in Rome, Antiochus IV, he lived as a free young adult. He was surrounded by the rich aristocratic youth. He received the same education as his Roman counterparts. And he was captivated by the city of Rome, and he was captivated by the culture of the diplomatic circles as well. So while birth he was a Seleucid, by nature he was a scandalous Roman in many ways. Now, following some years in the Roman court, rubbing shoulders with the young aristocracy there, historical sources say it's probably somewhere between 7 and 12 years there, then his brother sent for him from when he became king, when Seleucus Philopater became king. He sent for him, and on his way back to Syria, Antiochus Epiphanes stopped in Athens, and while he was there, he became a Greek citizen, and he even obtained a high office as the understudy of the chief magistrate of Athens. So he was a trained lawyer while in Rome. And then upon finally hearing about the death of his brother, Seleucus Philopater, while he was in Greece, that is when he returned to take the throne himself. So while he was a Seleucid by birth, he was trained in Roman ways, trained in matters of the law as well when he was in Greece, and then he came to take the throne. Again, here in Daniel chapter 11 and verse 21, it talks about him obtaining the throne by flatteries. Now, the historian Roland, he relates about this taking of the kingdom. He said he did not obtain the crown either by right of birth, as his brother Seleucus had left behind him his son, who was the lawful heir, or by a free choice of the people. He was not democratically elected. He won the hearts of the people instead by his artifices and a special appearance of clemency. So he won the hearts of them through affectation of Roman manners, as another historian talked about. He laid on the charm and he won the hearts of the people, yet it wasn't by vote of the people, and he wasn't the rightful heir of the people. Now, what about the character of Antiochus Epiphanes? Let's talk about that for a bit. Who was he? What was his personality like? Now, we've read that the Bible here describes in prophetic terms that he was going to be a vile person. And looking at history, it indeed does support this and illustrates it very clearly. He was a man of unrestrained emotions, passion, and evil, yet at the same time, intellectually brilliant. Intellectually brilliant. This is what Mr. Bevan writes. He's a famous author that wrote The House of Seleucus, something written in the early 19th century, a book, and he compiled a lot of the original sources of the history of Antiochus Epiphanes, Polybus and such. And I'll quote it by him at length throughout this radio show. But this is what he talks about. He gives a little introduction to the character of Antiochus Epiphanes. He says, "These Roman influences acting upon some temperaments might have made it tell powerfully in the world to valuable ends." I mean, he received a pretty good education. But in Antiochus, they were thrown away, owing to the incurable superficiality of his character. His imagination and sentiment outran his reason. Pageantry, theatrical display were his delight. The reign of his quiet brother, as in Seleucus Philopater, looked tame beside this. Within its spirited movement and bold action, but it was Seleucus Philopater, his brother, who amassed the money, and Antiochus Epiphanes, who left the kingdom bankrupt. While, therefore, he loved the splendor of royalty, its gold and its purple, its fanfares and its titles, the restrained and solemnity of court etiquette he found an intolerable boredom. He loved the power, he loved the title, but he got bored with the restraints that being an officer of court put on him. In essence, he wanted the power of a king, but he didn't want to act kingly. And from this sense, we get that we think that it looks like Antiochus Epiphanes, he was bored with the conventional class distinction between the people and the king. And he wanted the royal power, though. He wanted to use the power that a king would, but he wanted the freedom to give in to his moods without regard to the social norms of his fathers. He was like a child with massive amounts of power and money, an actor completely based on emotion until it was really important, and then he was extremely clever. Now, Bevan gives some examples of his nature, and I'd just like to cover a couple of anecdotes of the life of Antiochus. And I'll read here from Bevan once again. He says, "At night, when the great city hummed," that is Antioch, the capital of the Syrian Empire, "at night, when the great city hummed around his palace with the murmur of obscure revelry, he was often," that is Antiochus, "drawn forth by the craving to share in the free life that went on in the in those populous streets. He would give his courtiers the slip and plunge in down into the alleys with one or two of his friends. Often some party of young men drinking late together might hear the noise of a fresh company of revelers drawing near with horns and psalteries and be startled by the sudden apparition of the king. Sometimes, at midday, he would be seen flushed with wine, tossing money by handfuls into the street. People had met him, crowned with roses and habited in cloth of gold, wandering on some unknown quest, and it was advisable not to follow him. From such curiosity, he was capable of defending himself with stones even. Even the life of grooms and porters had a curiosity for him, and any one of the cosmopolitan crowd which flowed through Antioch might find that they had the king for a companion. He bathed in the public baths, and once, when his slaves brought the unguents which furnished the royal toilet, precious gums from which Asia was ransacked, some fellow of the crowd yelled out, 'You kings are lucky people to use such things as that smell so good.' And Antiochus Epiphanes mocked him, and the next day ordered a vessel of choice myrrh to be broken upon the man's head. And there was a general rush to wallow in the spilt unguent, a scrimmage and tumble on the slippery floor, in which, among shrieks of laughter, the king joined in." So you can see here that he had this desire to be one of the people, to act in ways that people would consider very uncomely for a king. He loved to do the unexpected, and he used the wealth that his brother brought to the kingdom as he was raising taxes for that purpose. He was a creature of a lot of energy, a lot of zeal, but there was nothing princely about him. Bevan continues and says here, his caprices, or his ability to change his mind without reason, ran near insanity. Although his engaging geniality might be assumed to cover some deadly purpose, his incalculable vein had its sinister aspect. He felt no difficulty in pleasantries with the man at whom he designed to strike. There was something horribly dangerous and panther-like in his caresses. Now, reading through Bevan's examples of this man, it's easy to see how the Bible prophesied that Antiochus would be a vile man. He held absolute power, yet without absolute restraint. Completely lawless, without any concern for those he ruled over, or at times for what people thought of him. In fact, he was a law unto himself. Now, that's witnessed in his name as well. We go on talking about him being Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, that's the name that he called himself. He's Antiochus IV. He gave himself the name Epiphanes, which means God manifest, or God in the flesh. Now, he didn't just believe that he was God's chosen instrument on earth. He actually believed he was God in the flesh. And through that, obviously exhibited an incredible narcissism. Now, greatest among a lot of the pleasures of Antiochus was his love for festivity. All over the empire, he constructed gymnasiums in the Hellenistic cities where youth were trained and educated in Greek thought, as well as the Greek gladiatorial games that we know so much about. And at one such of those games in Antioch, in which the whole Greek world was participated, Antiochus Epiphanes, he exhibited more of those qualities true to his nature. This is what Bevan writes of one of these gladiatorial games and festivities that took place in Antioch that Epiphanes arranged. Bevan says Antiochus was in his element. He outdid himself in indiscriminate familiarity. Functions which would naturally have been left to subordinates, he insisted on performing himself, riding up and down on the procession, shouting orders, standing at the palace door to usher in the guests, marshalling the attendants. He was up and down among the banqueters, sitting, standing, declaiming, drinking, and bandying jest with the professional murmurs. The crowning moment this evening was towards the end of the feast, when the company had begun to grow thin. The murmurs, or the jesters, they brought in a swaddled figure and laid it upon the ground. Suddenly, at the notes of the symphony, it started from its wrappings, and the king stood there naked. So he arranged himself to be part of the entertainment, and there was Antiochus Epiphanes naked, just to get a reaction from the people there. Now, the banquet at that point pretty much broke up, and Bevan continues, the festivities were hardly over, and Antioch clear of the mob of revelers, when the ominous face of the Roman envoy thrust itself upon the scene. Gracchus headed a mission which came, after all this blare of trumpets, to see what was going on. They were on watch for some sign of ill will in the Seleucid king, some coolness in their entertainment, but never had Antiochus been more genial and charming. So the Romans here, that which Antiochus was actually somewhat fearful of, they were coming, so he realized that he needs to change his tact, change his attitude, change his actions. So the Romans he put in his own palace at their disposal and surrounded them with the state of kings. They returned, these Romans, declaring that it was incredible that this man could be cherishing any serious designs, that there were few who could cover so deadly hate with such disarming manners. I mean, we see, you know, these type of characteristics in the world today, with this ability to put on an air of extreme geniality that people swoon with, that swoon by, that cause people to get wrapped up in a personality. And yet, at other times, we can see the complete lack of care for what other people think. So appalled at Antiochus' exploits at the games, these Romans approached him, and they found an incredibly different man, full of decorum and charm. And really, this highlights Antiochus's ability to hide his true motives and convince others that his objectives were honorable. This is the way, well, this is the character of Antiochus Epiphanes. But how did he rule? How did he look after the people that he was over, this Seleucid Empire? Now, we don't know too much about his internal rule up in Antioch, but we can tell that he did rule with a strong hand. One example of his desire to maintain power is how he set up a couple of friends from his youth that he met in Athens, and he let them to have some high positions within the Seleucid kingdom. He chose them not because of their ability, but because he was assured of their loyalty. He was a pretty good builder of Antioch. He built a lot of luxurious baths and things like that. And he had a pretty strong desire in those construction efforts to transform the territory into a completely Greek state. Now, while he was from Syria, we have to remember that his empire, the Seleucid Empire, came out of Alexander the Great, a Greek empire. So whether they're in Egypt, whether they're the Ptolemies or the Seleucids, they're all pretty much Greek. Yet the Ptolemies ruled in a different way in Egypt. They allowed people to, while they did promote Greek culture, it wasn't forced upon them. And even Antiochus the Great, Antiochus Epiphanes' father, while he did promote Hellenism or Greek way of life and thought, he didn't thrust it upon the people and say, you must observe our Greek way of thinking or our Greek culture. But with Antiochus Epiphanes, it was different. He went about converting the entire region into a Hellenized power. And the major foreign policy of Antiochus Epiphanes then, after he had Hellenized his own territory strongly, more so than his father had, was to secure Egypt for himself. There were a number of different wars, 5 or 6 or 7 wars that took place between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, now down in Egypt. So if you've got a map out and you look at where Syria is today, you can just take that as being around the headquarters of the Seleucid Empire. And then you look where Egypt is, and what's right in the middle of that? Obviously, it's the land of Judea. Now, as Antiochus Epiphanes would venture back and forth to Egypt with his army, he would travel through the land of Judea. And on the way down to Egypt and on the way back from Egypt, he was going to inflict some of the most brutal policies of ethnic and religious cleansings against the Jews that this world has ever seen. Now, Antiochus Epiphanes, just to give you some dates, if we look at the dates of his reign, he started reigning in 175 BC. And when he came to the throne, the Jewish high priest at the time, who was basically the Jewish state was a vassal to the Seleucid Empire, the Jewish high priest was Onias III, and he was at odds with King Antiochus Epiphanes. That's not to say that he was against Hellenism, but he was at odds with him because one of his brother named Joshua went up and saw Antiochus Epiphanes in Antioch and said, I want to be high priest in Jerusalem. Let me be high priest in Jerusalem. I will get you a lot of money and I'm going to turn Jerusalem itself into a Greek city, a polis. Now, Antiochus Epiphanes loved this idea. He didn't care about the high priestly line going all the way back to Zadok, as it still did at this time, Zadok during David's time. And Antiochus agreed. And he allowed this guy, Joshua, or Jason, as he changed his name to turn Jerusalem into a Hellenized Greek city. He educated the Jews in the Greek way of life. He set up a gymnasium. He taught Greek philosophy. He allowed them to participate in the naked Greek games. Some of the Jewish men actually went and had certain surgeries to try and hide the fact that they were Jewish. Now, a lot of Jewish literature from this time and thereafter would like to paint the picture of this battle, incoming battle between Antiochus Epiphanes and the Jews, as the Jewish nation was righteous, true to the religion of God, and they were set upon by the mad Antiochus and his Hellenizing ways. Now, the fact of the matter is that the Jews themselves invited Hellenism into the city before Antiochus Epiphanes ever forced them into Hellenism. They did this of their own accord. And looking at Daniel chapter 11, that's exactly what it says there as well. Bevan writes this about this period. The conversion to Hellenic cities was not something which the king compelled ancient communities to undergo, that is his father. It was something which he conceded as a favor. Envoys from such communities were sent about the court petitioning that they might be allowed through the king's authority to set up a gymnasium and to register its inhabitants such as Hellenists. And that's what Jason wanted to do. There was enough force and attraction to Hellenism itself to render compulsion, had Antiochus contemplated it, superfluous. And he's just saying people wanted to go towards Hellenism because there was a natural inclination to go there. It was the way of the world. It was the way of the ruling aristocracy through the whole known world, whether it's Greece, Rome, Syria, Egypt. Hellenism was the thought of the day. So most people were willing to go along with that, especially those in higher society. Bevan continues that the temptation to conform with the fashion of the world should not have been felt in Judea is impossible, saying that it's impossible that the Jews didn't fall for this as well. The new stateliness of the Hellenized cities, the magnificence of Alexandria and Antioch, would beset the peculiar people, that is the Jews, with the lust of the eyes and the pride of life. The temptation would, of course, appeal to the rich, the dwellers in Jerusalem, rather than the poor and the countryside. And if we can say anything about the history of the Jews, when Antiochus IV came to reign in Syria, it is that a part of the Jerusalem aristocracy were ready enough to make friends with the rulers of this Hellenized world. And then his final quote here says, it's a cardinal fact to be grasped in estimating the policy of Antiochus Epiphanes, that the initiative in the Hellenizing of Jerusalem was not on the side of King Antiochus, but on the Jews themselves. Attacked by the materialism of the day, the social thought of the day, the progressiveness of the day, the Jews forgot about the law of God. Or they started to not be as strict in its observance. They accepted Hellenism, and what's in direct contradiction to Hellenism or to individualism, to exalting human thought, it is the Bible that says this is right, this is wrong, no matter what you think about it. And the Jews liked the philosophy. Now, it was because of this fact that the sin, really, had already abounded within the nation of Judea, that Antiochus Epiphanes was allowed initially to have his way. Now, Joshua wasn't high priest for too long, though. In 171 BC, a few years later, Menelaus, who was a Benjamite, he approached Antiochus Epiphanes and said, this Joshua character, who is now high priest, that you made high priest, he isn't Hellenizing Jerusalem fast enough. I've got a group with me. I can Hellenize it faster. And in fact, I can get you more money as well. The yearly tribute, I will be able to pay you. Now, again, a higher yearly tribute. Now, Menelaus, he wasn't even of the line of Zadok, and Antiochus Epiphanes didn't care about that, obviously, and said, sure, you can now be the high priest. Now, about this same time, in around 171, 172, Antiochus Epiphanes was down in Egypt, and he was waging a successful battle down there. And as he was there, though, news got to Jerusalem that Antiochus had been killed. And because of that, those that were supportive of Joshua put down Menelaus's reign as the high priest and set up Joshua, who wasn't a righteous guy, who was already into Hellenism, but they just didn't like Menelaus in power. But big problem, Antiochus Epiphanes wasn't dead. News got back to Antiochus that what they had done to the guy that he set in power, Menelaus, and he took his wrath out on the Jews on his way back up to Syria. Now he started to allow Menelaus to really Hellenize the kingdom of Judea a lot faster, or the province of Judea a lot faster at that time. But that's not when he took out his major wrath on the Jews. That was the next time. Let's go over to Daniel chapter 11 here. You're probably still there. And go over to verse number 29. Verse 29 says, "And at the time appointed, he shall return." That is, Antiochus Epiphanes is going to return down into Egypt. He's going to come towards the south. He's going to go into Egypt, but it shall not be as the former, in the sense that he's not going to be effective in the battle against the Egyptians. Why? Verse 30, "For the ships of Chittim shall come against him." Now, Chittim here, or Kittim, is the ancient name for Cyprus, and there were going to be ships stationed in Cyprus, which was the Roman fleet that came to meet Antiochus just as he was on the Nile Delta about to inflict his rage on Egypt. And it's pretty interesting. This is one of the most famous actions in Antiochus Epiphanes' life, because what you had is the Roman envoy Papilius there. He got out off his ship, went up to meet Antiochus Epiphanes, and the historical documents even kind of show that they knew each other, and Antiochus Epiphanes wasn't upset to see him at that moment. But this Roman emissary hands him a tablet, and it basically says, "You're not going to fight against Egypt, or Rome's going to declare war on you." And at that point, it looked like Antiochus was going to try and retreat, go back, talk to his advisors, and see what he was going to do. But then Papilius gets his sword or his walking stick, one of the two, and draws a circle around Antiochus Epiphanes and said, "Yea or nay, before you leave this circle," making him answer him whether you're going to fight us or whether you're going to go back. Now, he wasn't completely stupid. He was an intelligent man. So he realized at this point, it's dangerous. It's dangerous to fight against the Romans. I'm going to retreat. Now, at this point is when he starts to really vent his anger on the Jews on his way back up to Antioch. Look here in verse 30. We stopped reading partway through. It says, "The ships of Chittim shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the holy covenant." So he's going to take his anger out on the Jews. "So shall he do, he shall even return and have intelligence with them that forsake the holy covenant." Again, remember, there were people that were in bed with Antiochus already. But the wrath he took out on the Jews, it's stunning. Stunningly bad. Horrific. It went past just pure human hatred and emotion. This is what Christopher Wordsworth, he's a 19th century British clergyman, he wrote about this history, and I think it captures the dichotomy here of thinking about whether this was a human, whether this was more than just human anger being vented against the Jews. He writes, "The secret springs of this impious purpose is not easy to discover. We can readily comprehend why an ambitious monarch should invade a neighboring province, and why a covetous prince should pillage an opulent temple in an ancient city, in order to aggrandize and enrich himself. But why, after he had done all this, he should proceed to compel the inhabitants of that province and city, and worshippers in the temple, as Antiochus Epiphanes endeavored to force the Jews, to eat certain meats prohibited as unclean by their laws, and to give up the copies of their sacred books to be burned, and to partake in idolatrous sacrifices, and to join in idolatrous processions? And why should he forbid them to circumcise their children, and to observe their Sabbaths and holy days, and to offer the daily sacrifice? And why should he proceed to torture and destroy thousands of them, his own subjects?" Then he says, "For my own part, I frankly confess," this is Wordsworth now talking about, or just thinking about what he did, "that I recognize here the workings of the evil one." And indeed, when you look at what Antiochus Epiphanes did, it could be comparable to the World War II Holocaust of the Jews. I'm not going to read too many of the details of what he did to the Jews, but one of them, he hung the babies, circumcised babies, around their mother's necks, hanging them both. I mean, this was brutal, this policy of extreme Hellenism, and then destroying any copy of the law that he could find, any copy of the Constitution he could find, was beyond just human wrath. It was more than just that. Yes, he did destroy many, many of the Jews, but he wasn't just satisfied with that. He had a greater desire, Antiochus Epiphanes, and that was the complete destruction of God's word. Now, the history we can get from this period, it's written in the first book of Maccabees. Now, this is generally assumed, well, not even assumed, it's counted as historically accurate. It looks to have been written by an eyewitness at the time. And this is what First Maccabees, that is different to Second, Third, Fourth Maccabees. They were written far after the events that they purport to describe. This was written by an eyewitness, though. It says, "The king wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people and that each should give up his customs. And all the Gentiles accepted the command of the king, and then also many from Israel gladly adopted his religion." So this is talking about some that didn't stand up, most that didn't stand up, and they started to obey what he wanted. In the temple, he set up a statue of Zeus. And then on the altar of sacrifice, just out the front of the temple, they sacrificed swine's flesh on that as well. They forced people to eat unclean meats. They circumcised their sons. And then again, wherever they found anybody obeying the law, the constitution of the Jews, the Bible, they were put to death. That was his commandment. That was his judicial or his royal decree from the top. Anybody obeying this law should be put to death. If I find this book in anyone's presence, that person is put to death. Now, it's amazing that he would take out this wrath on a religion that didn't really, you know, Judaism and the Jews at that time, they weren't anything to worry about. I mean, they weren't a massive kingdom. They didn't once try and rebel in the past 100 years from the Seleucid rule. But he wanted to wipe out their spirit, and he wanted to wipe out the truth as well. Now, what would have happened if nobody stood up to Antiochus Epiphanes? That nobody said to him, "No, you're not destroying the law of our fathers." Then likely the book that we have before us that we're reading from, Daniel chapter 11, wouldn't have even made it through. Most of the copies of the law at this point, the Bible, they were still in Judea. And he was stamping out every last bit of scripture that he could find in Judea. And if some people hadn't been zealous for the law of God, for the law of their fathers, for their own constitution, he would have destroyed it. And when we'll come back, we'll look at the inspiring prophesied reaction to this plot by Antiochus to destroy the law of God.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily. We were just talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, his policy of destroying any vestige of the truth that he could find amongst the Jews. But as I mentioned before, there were some, just a few at the beginning, that were willing to stand up to the emperor. And this, you know, he would have been successful, Antiochus Epiphanes, at stamping out the truth of God at this point, if not for one man and his family. And this started in the small town of Modin at the very north of Judean territory. Now, this man's name was Mattathias, and of him would come the family of the Hasmoneans that are known to history today as the Hasmoneans or the Maccabees. He was a Levitical priest. He wasn't a Levite that worked at the temple. No, he was right on the edge of the Judean kingdom. And Antiochus Epiphanes sent down his representatives to Judea to ensure everyone in this province would get rid of their copies of the law and would worship their own pagan gods. This is what 1 Maccabees says of the time that these Seleucid emissaries came down to this town of Mattathias, where Mattathias was, the town's name being Modin. Then the king's officers who were enforcing the apostasy came to the city of Modin to make them offer sacrifice. Many from Israel came to them, and Mattathias and his sons were assembled. So you get the sense that they are in this central courtyard, if you like, or where the market is in the city. And then it continues here, this quote from 1 Maccabees. It says, the king's officers spoke to Mattathias as follows. You are leader, honored and great in this city, and supported by sons and brothers. Now be the first to come and do what the king commands, as all the Gentiles and the men of Judah and those that are left in Jerusalem have done. So you get the sense here that he said, everyone else in Judea, everyone else in Jerusalem have done this. They have sacrificed to pagan idols. Now be like everybody else, you leader Mattathias, and come here and sacrifice this pagan the swine upon this altar that we have created. And then you'll be numbered among the friends of the kings, as it says. Now, I think it's just really interesting to note that how many people of the Jews had already succumbed to Hellenism, had not put up a fight, had initially invited this by their own transgression to come upon the city. And it was only in the far-flung city of Judea that somebody was willing to say no, and not just say no to some ordinary person, but say no to an emperor. Of course, Antiochus wasn't there at the time, just his emissary was. But Mattathias responds to the representative here of Antiochus Epiphanes. This is continuing in 1 Maccabees, but Mattathias answered and said in a loud voice, even if all the nations that live under the rule of the king obey him and have chosen to do his commandments, departing each from the religion of his fathers, yet I and my sons and my brothers will live by the covenant of our fathers. Far be it from us to desert the law and the ordinances. We will not obey the king's words by turning aside from our religion to the right hand or to the left. So he's like, no, we're not going to give up our law. At that point, a Jew from the midst of them, somebody else from the city, went ahead and went up to the altar and said, well, I'm not dying here with everybody else. And he sacrificed the swine upon the altar. At which point, Mattathias, this aged man probably at this time, went and his sons killed that Jew that just accepted pagan worship and then also put to death those emissaries, Seleucid emissaries that were there, representing Antiochus Epiphanes. Verse 26 here of 1 Maccabees chapter 2 says this, thus he burned with zeal for the law, as Phinehas did against Zimri the son of Sulu. Then Mattathias cried out in the city with a loud voice, saying, let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenant come with me. And he and his sons fled to the hills and left all they had in the city. Now this, we're running out of time here, but this was the very beginning of what is known as the Maccabean Revolt, that after 3 years, they are going to remove most of the presence of the Seleucid forces out of Judea and Jerusalem. They're going to reestablish the daily sacrifice upon the altar of sacrifice after they rebuild it. And he said here, Mattathias, who's zealous of the law and who wants to follow me? Who wants to come and be strong and stand up for the law of our fathers? Let's just go to one last verse over here in Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11, verse 30. Because we can read in verse 31 there that it talks about the work that Antiochus would do. But verse 32 is positive. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall he corrupt by flatteries. But the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. Now, we know that this has end time significance, but it also had significance back then originally amongst this family of people that though the whole nation had turned away the constitution of their land, the Bible, the holy word of God, they wouldn't do it. There were a few people that knew their God and did exploits. Do you know your God? Do we? Well, sometimes that means being like Mattathias, being like the Maccabees. It means being zealous when somebody wants to turn away from that truth or take away that truth. Now, I'm not talking about taking up arms or anything like that, but I am talking about supporting a warning message about that truth, that which you can hear on this program. We're living in an age where the spirit of Antiochus Epiphanes is everywhere, especially through the nations of modern Israel. Now, if you want to learn what it means to be strong and do exploits in the face of Antiochus's deception that exists even to this day, you need to request and read, if you haven't already, reread, or if you have read it already, reread it, America Under Attack. You can find that at thetrumpet.com. You're listening to KPCG 101.3 FM there in Edmond. We're coming to you from Jerusalem today, and you can catch the live stream all the way around the world on kpcg.fm. Thanks for joining us.